Welcome to the podcast. I'm Larry Matthews. We're joined by Vicki Pinpin Feinstein. Vicki Pinpin Feinstein has written a book called A Thousand Little Deaths. This is kind of a first for us on these podcasts. This is no doubt the first time we have interviewed someone who's written a nonfiction book about being held as a political prisoner. Not only was she held as a political prisoner, she was a schoolgirl at the time. Vicki, welcome.
Thank you, Larry. I'm glad to be here.
So let's talk about your book, A Thousand Little Deaths. First off, before we get into the topic of the book here, how did you come up with this title?
Yes, that's a very good question. But as I was, it took me a long time to write the book. But one day, one of the things that I was trying to feel and to sense when I was writing, aside from thinking about how to write it, was what feelings did I have of those times? And one of the things that came up to me, these words just came up, it felt like dying all the time. Dying particularly every time I had to go back to the camp to report, because I was released after a month, but I was told that my release was conditional, that I had to report to the camp and sign my name in a logbook every other day.
So let's give a little background on this. You were living in the Philippines at the time.
Correct.
You were going to a private, was it a Catholic school?
Correct, yes.
And Marcos was the was running the country at the time, was the dictator.
That is correct. Marcos came into power in 1965, the first time he was, he won the election against Diosdado Macapagal, who is the president before him and also the father of Gloria Macapagal Arroyo, who was the president just before this one, Benigno Aquino III. Then Marcos was reelected to power in 1969, and he went on to be there until 1986, when, as you know, with the people power in 1986, he was booted out and actually flew to Hawaii with his family.
So let's get back to what was happening to you. You are going to a school, and some men show up at the school. You are, what, 15 years old? Maybe, a sophomore?
I was a junior in high school, 15 years old. I had been at that school. It's called St. Scholasticus Academy. It was founded by German nuns in 1925, and my parents and her sisters had gone there, so we also went there, my sisters and I. I had been there, like I said, since pre-K, and then went on to finish high school there. I was in my last year of high school when this happened. I was 15 years old.
So talk about that. Tell us what happened. I know in your book you have a very vivid description of you're there and you're having a normal school day and you get called into the office.
That's exactly what it was. I mean, like any morning, I got dressed that morning when I woke up. You know, we had a helper at home who makes our lunch, and then, you know, we went off to school, and sometime I would say between 9 and 10 in the morning, I was listening to a teacher doing her lecture in our classroom, it was on the third floor of the building, and, you know, someone from the principal's office came to talk to the teacher and whispered something to her, and she came over to my desk, and she said, you are wanted at the principal's office. So I went there, and when I did, I saw four men in combat fatigues standing around the desk of the principal. And as soon as she saw me, she could barely look at me straight. And this is a woman who we all feared. You know, she was very stern, very strict. She almost always growled at you. And all of a sudden, her expression was completely different this time. And then she just told me without any introduction, wanted you to go with them, you know. And she didn't explain why or whatever. She just said, they're taking you with them.
So did you ever find out why? I mean, were you kind of rabble-rouser? Was your family working against the regime?
Not on that day. Not on that day. This happened in 1973, a year after Marcus had declared martial law in the country on September 21, 1972. Right before and the years after martial law, many, many Filipinos were arrested. And until it wasn't until 1977 that they were able to, a group of people and lawmakers were able to say, you know, they cannot just keep people in jail.
But it does kind of get us to the question of why. I mean, did they ever say, well, you know, we didn't like your family. We didn't like you. You have done something to offend us.
No explanation needed at that time. They arrested anybody they think was a threat to them. I was never charged, and so did many other people. I was there for a month. Nobody told me what I did. So all these years, I figured, you know, I had joined one demonstration that was, at that time, there were a lot of student demonstrations all over the world in the 60s, early 70s. And this one was against the hikes in tuition in many schools. So I was there, and so was my sister. So were thousands of other people. Why I was the one arrested, it was never explained to me to this very day. The only other thing that I could think of was that I was recruited to attend a meeting to talk about why the government is unjust and all that stuff. And they were talking about some type of leftist communist principles that I didn't even understand. And like I said, there was nothing written while I was there or told to me while I was in camp what I had done wrong. They just, you know, what they did say is that you are an activist. You are.
So somehow they got a hold of a list or the names of the people who had maybe attended this meeting and your name was on there. And so they just did a sweep and picked you up.
That is most likely what happened, because I understand that there are what they call informers in those meetings. And even at school, it could be something that you had said in school somebody had reported you, you know, because there were children of the military, of soldiers studying at our school at that time. And who knows? I will never know. What happened? I will never know if I was on that list, but that's what I speculated later.
So now they take you away. They take you to this camp. What was that like?
That is tough. It's the very first day, it felt like a light was, it just went dim, you know? I was always frightened. Because I had, at that time, we have heard a lot of stories about people disappearing and were never found. We knew that torture was happening. We knew that rape with women was happening. We knew that the soldiers just did whatever they could, you know, to inflict harm, damage, injury, even death, many times death with people. So I didn't want to think about that. So I think because I was 15 years old, my mind just went blank. So in the beginning, I didn't really know what to do. I tried to read, but we were not allowed reading materials. A lot of things were censored. We couldn't hear the news, except for when family members came to visit us. We were not provided meals. The soldiers told us that it's up to your family to provide meals for you. So if you didn't have any family around, it's just your bad luck. But what prisoners, other people do is they share their food with everybody. And my whole month there, I hardly ate anyway because of the fear. I just couldn't eat. I didn't have any appetite. So I mostly gave my food away. Our family has a driver who would give me my breakfast and lunch, and then comes again in the late afternoon for my dinner.
Did you stay in, was it a jail or was it like a barracks?
No, it wasn't. Where I was a military camp with no jail, because it was a where there were jails, they were their field, you know. Where there should be two in a room, there were like maybe three or four people in a jail cell. So they took us to this other camp extension, and what we did is during the day they told us to stay at the conference room. And at night, there were only two women, me and this other woman who was actually pregnant. She was about 19 or 20 years old. She was very pregnant. And she and I were the only females of a group of maybe 20 to 25, and it changes every day who's going to be there. So we were given cots at night, and we slept, believe it or not, in the provincial commander's office.
So were you the only teenager there, the only student?
Yes. The youngest men were probably in their late teens. I don't know if they were ever even in school, but I was definitely the youngest.
Did you ever have a chance to talk to the others about why they were there and why you were there? And did anybody know anything?
Those are not conversations that we were supposed to do. They discouraged us from really talking to each other about why it is that we were there.
So let's talk about what happened during your day. Did they interrogate you? Did they bring you into some place and say, we have you here for the following reasons and we want you to confess to the following things?
No, that's not how it happened. The only time I was interviewed or interrogated was the day that I was arrested. But because of my fear, and I guess because of the trauma, I couldn't remember. In my book, I wrote about how there were a few hours there that I don't remember really what happened. And to this day, I don't remember. I knew that I was in the interrogation room with the provincial commander. My sister was outside, my sister by 2 years. She's older than me, Timmy, by 2 years. She was outside waiting for our parents. She came with us, and I didn't know this until she told me 20 years later that she was there with us, and she insisted that she come with me. And she was waiting for her parents. She didn't know what camp they're going to take me to. She said she was very scared for me inside, but she wasn't allowed to go in. I don't know what they asked me because I can't remember to this day. But that was the only interrogation that I was given.
So the rest of it was just kind of hanging around the camp waiting to get out?
Yes. Correct.
And so they let you out after a month, and then they tell you you have to come back and check in now and then?
Every other day.
Every other day?
For the first 2 years, 2.5 years, it was every other day. Then they changed it, reduced it to once a week for another year, and then it was every 2 weeks and then once a month. And that went on for 5 years.
Wow. So what were your parents thinking? I mean, did they have any inkling about why any of this had happened?
There are two things that I want to say about this. One is that they were just happy that I was back home. Two, we never talk about it afterwards for a variety of reasons. One, my father was a senior government official heading a regional agency, government agency. He was the director. In fact, his office was not very far from the camp where I was. So, he can't say publicly what he thinks because we were still under martial law. And the military was very repressive, and so was Marcus, of course, who was the head of it all. Number two is that culturally, that was Filipino parents are, they don't, like American parents, they don't say they love you all the time. They show it, but they won't, you know, they're not as verbal as Asians generally are not that way. So that was very, very difficult for them, I could tell. And it wasn't until almost 30 years later when I was actually writing this book that I asked my older sister what my parents thought. And it was at the back of the book, the last chapter, where this conversation happened, and I related in the final chapter of the book where I talk about what my parents thought. They were very proud of me. They thought that I stood for my principles. They didn't like Marcus, but they couldn't say so because it was a very dangerous time. So that was it was something, and I remember telling my sister when she told me that, you know, I wish I was 15 again, and Mom and Dad were telling me exactly what you're telling me now.
Sure, yeah. So the book is 1,000 Little Deaths by Vicky Pinpin Feinstein. Where can we get this book?
This book is available as an ebook on Amazon, of course, and then it also comes in other ebook platforms, Nook, Sunny, the Apple iBookstore, Kobo, and a few others that are available worldwide. And then, of course, it also comes as print on demand on Amazon. So I look forward to finding out if you guys are interested, if any reader is interested in reading the story. I would love to find out what you think.
It's a great story. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Larry.